My Radio 1. Sean Tilly. With Sean Tilly.
From its launch in 1967, right through the 70s to the mid-80s, BBC Radio 1 was probably the world's biggest music station. In this series, I'm introducing you to many of the people behind the network's success during those golden years, as they each tell the story of their Radio 1.
It's a happy, happy sound.
My Radio 1.
With Sean Tilly.
You've been listening to part two of the Island Records story, narrated by Pete Drummond. The series is researched, written and produced by Jeff Griffin for Radio 1 in association with Island Records.
And that is more than a little clue pointing to the identity of the guest in this edition of My Radio 1. It is legendary producer and Radio 1 live music guru, the great Jeff Griffin. Welcome.
Hi, Sean. Good to be here.
Jeff, it is lovely to see you. And you were there right at the very start, obviously the station launching 30th September 1967. We'll talk about the first Radio 1 programme that you produced very soon, but how long had you been with the BBC before that?
I started at the BBC in 1959 as what was known as a probationary technical operator. I was the first intake from straight from school, because up to then they only used to take engineers in who'd done their national service. I missed national service by 1 year. My birthday is actually also the 30th September. I was born on the 30th September 1940, so I thought it was rather good of Radio 1 to start on my birthday.
27th birthday. Yeah. Wow.
But I managed to get an attachment to the old pop music department in beginning of 1964. While I was there, two or three producers got other jobs in television and so on and so forth, and so I went in for a board for the two or three producers' jobs going, and I was lucky enough to get one of those. I was totally surprised. I was 23, didn't really expect to, if I ever became a producer, till much later in my life.
Right, children, from the top again. Thank you. Right now.
It happens on a Sunday.
Very good, very good. Thank you, Myrtle. Myrtle, don't do that.
Never on a Monday, a Tuesday, a Wednesday, a Thursday, a Friday, not even Saturday.
All right, well, it's the last program, and you've done beautifully.
Only on a Sunday, happening Sunday. It happens on a Sunday every week.
And this week on the show, the Johnny Howard Band and Singers, the Peddlers, and Cat Stevens. Lovely music. Well, we've heard the American version of this before by Robert Knight. Now we're going to hear the English cover version by The Love Affair, Everlasting Love!
And the first ever programme that you produced on Radio 1?
Oh, the first one on Radio 1 was Happening Sunday with Ed Stewart.
Yeah.
What had happened is that Ron Belcher had a very good Sunday morning programme with David Simons, which was getting very good figures. And the powers that be decided they would use David for the evening programmes, the drive time programmes.
Radio 1, David Simons.
David Simons? Fantastic. Full kettle on, mother.
The other ones are still the best, aren't they? I think I shall crawl back into my little hole and I shall forget forever the idea of doing anything new. Anyway, for all mothers who are listening to Radio 1 this evening, here's your record, and it comes from Barry Ryan. A Clive Westlake composition. Come on, Barry, and tell us what it's called.
You mentioned David Simons was doing the Sunday mornings. You did eventually end up working with him during the afternoons. He was he was quite a different figure, for even though he hadn't got a pirate radio background, he had a BBC background, but he was very pirate in his approach to the job, wasn't he?
Yeah, well, David had quite an interesting background. You're right, he was had been a BBC staff announcer, but he had also worked for New Zealand radio. He'd been out there for a while, and a very knowledgeable sort of guy, and very into his pop
Fantastic
music
voice
as, well.
As well.
And I had become very good friends with him, actually, even before Radio 1 started, because he was very into Moody Blues and so on. I'd been to some the recording sessions with him for that at Broadhurst Road, the Decca's recording studios. So I was quite happy to work with him. We had a good relationship going. And that was myself and Bev Phillips working to Ron Belcher. He was the overall editor of that programme.
It was within a couple of years of Radio 1 launching that you gained your formidable reputation of producing live performances on the network. How did all that start?
Well, I'd actually had an idea for a concert programme years and years beforehand. In fact, back in 64, I recorded a programme in front of an audience with Georgie Fame and Manfred Mann called Rockin' in Rhythm. And that was eventually broadcast. Unfortunately, on the night of the second election in 1964, that it kept being interrupted by election results. But I never got any further idea until the days of Radio 1. And Alan Black and I were discussing the idea of having live bands in with an audience and so on and so forth. And he was very keen to present it. In the meantime, I was doing a session one day with Led Zeppelin I had one for an overseas programme, but I did one for Top Gear, John Peel's programme. And at the end of that session, this was at Maida Vale Studios, we went to the pub and Jimmy Page said, this is quite good doing this session and we can do longish numbers. So what we really like, and our thing is about extending ourselves, we'd really like to do something live. And I said, okay, that's what I've always wanted to do. Would you be prepared to do a pilot programme? So he said, well, I would. He said, and I'm sure the other guys would. And I'll talk to Peter about it, Peter Grant, their manager. And so that eventually came about and we did the pilot programme with Alan introducing it in the middle of 1969, and so I was waiting to see whether I'd get a commission out of that. Actually, I then did another one for Christmas 1969, which was with Moody Blues, a similar basis actually to Led Zeppelin. But then I did have a commission starting in January 1970 to do a 1-hour concert every week. And for the first programme, I booked Family. And unfortunately, Roger Chapman had sort of had a very bad voice, a bit like mine sounding at the moment. And so during the afternoon, John said, well, why don't we call up Mark and see whether he can come and sit in and do half an hour? And he meant Mark Boland. Fortunately, Mark only lived up at Regent's Park, quite near where John lived. So we gave him a call and he came down. So that first programme, which should have been a whole hour of the Family band, was half of them, mostly instrumentals and a bit of Roger stuttering through, and half an hour of Mark of Tyrannosaurus Rex.
Some of the acts they used to have in those early days, though, Jeff, they're incredible, because we've been going through the old Radio Times and what have you. Renaissance, of course, who eventually did have some singles chart success, but predominantly an album band, particularly in those days. And Elton John before he'd even had a hit as well.
Yeah. I've been aware of Elton for some time because he was employed by Dick James to write music along with Bernie Taupin, and my secretary's boyfriend and later husband Steve Brown wanted to get in the music business. He'd played with him before in the Checkmates. He was a musician himself. He got a job with Dick James, and when Dick James said, look, I want you to get these guys to write a bit more stuff, and when he found out what they'd been asked to write, he said, no, forget all that, I think you're better than that. And so through that I heard some of Elton's stuff. And in fact, I can remember one occasion when my wife and I lived in Chessington, Steve actually called in one night with Elton when they're actually on the way, because you probably know Elton used to do cover records for the Woolworths label. And one evening actually called in on the way. I can't remember why they called him, but there was reason, and they were on the way to do that. So I'd known Elton not ever so well, but I knew him. But more importantly, I was aware of the way his career was going to go, and so I was quite keen to get him in as soon as possible. And I think the first concert from memory was him and Hookfoot, who were backing him at the time.
And in those early days, as well as John, who we've talked about, and the late Alan Black, Bob Harris, you were working with very closely.
Well, Bob came to interview me for he'd started Time Out with Steve Elliott some years ago, and they'd had a bit of a falling out, and Bob was somebody else was coming up with some money. They were going to start if I'm right about this, going to start another similar magazine. So Bob went to interview various people. I think Doreen Davis was one, and John Peel, and one or both of them said, oh, you must talk to Jeff Griffin, he does the sort of music that you're interested in. And so we did the interview. I did an interview with Bob, And for this magazine, I don't think it ever came out, actually. But we went to the pub afterwards. So you'll find this comes up a lot in BBC stories, by the way, not just from me, but from lots of people. Pubs used to be very important in those days before everybody got into doing gym and so on. And we went round the pub and he was saying, you know, I'd really like to go to being a DJ and so on and so forth. Oh, no, not another one. So we discussed what sort of thing he'd like to do. So I said, well, I'll tell you what, I'll sort out a pilot program for you. So that's what we did. We recorded a one-hour program, and I played it to the senior producer in that department. And said, "Yeah, he sounds quite good. Maybe we could slot him in somewhere." So when John Peel was going on holiday, because the In Concert was running now, this was in 1970, it was running through, and John Peel was going on holiday or working abroad, I can't remember which, in August. So what we did these, as John used to call it, the Sunday repeated on Wednesday show. So I repeated for all the best concerts on the Sundays for August, but on the Wednesdays we had another Sounds of the 70s, but this time introduced by Bob, so he had four shows. So as far as he was concerned, he was so excited and did those and thought, well, you know, maybe I'll get a show eventually. And then, as he was wont to do, David Simons, who was doing the Monday Sounds of the 70s, imploded yet again. That was the only thing with David. He did have a habit of doing that sometimes. And I can't remember whether he resigned or whether he was sacked. I think he resigned. And suddenly there was a gap in September. This was only a few weeks after Bob had done the programmes for me. And so that's how Bob got his in, you know, and stayed there right until we had some cutbacks some years later.
And now Sounds of the 70s disc jockey Bob Harris, who compared the recent T-Rex tour, talks to Mark Bolan and tells us what the tour was all about.
You really are the first people to be making young people's music for a very long time. I mean, musically, there's no comparison, obviously, with the Beatles, but what's happening now to you is definitely comparable in the sense that it's communicating. Your music is communicating to the young people in very much the same way as the Beatles did in their time, in the way of self-identification. Sort of, do you agree with that?
It's sort of phase two of the youth culture thing.
Right.
I think it's really because kids, you know, I mean, I think people are aware that I'm a poet and I write, you know, there's another side to it, and I think they demand more than just, you know, someone going on doing a tune.
Mm.
You know, I think that the thing with people, I've found certainly with all the singles so far, people going and ask, have you got the new T-Rex single, please? They don't even ask for the title, which is a gas, because it means they trust me, you know.
Bob Harris introducing a compilation programme of some of the nicest music from the In Concert series. All solo artists on the programme tonight, and during the next 60 minutes or so, we'll be listening to music from people like Country Joe McDonald, Steve Torsten, Loudon Wainwright, Bryn Haas, Don McLean, Alan Hull, and Melanie, among others. But to start us off, here's music now from Chris de Burgh.
I mean, Mike Harding and Andy Dunkley, these were names that I almost forgot about. But again, looking through the old schedules, these guys were cropping up introducing In Concert in those days.
Well, the Mike Harding, by the way, is not the Mike Harding, the folk singer.
A lot of people made that mistake, don't they? Yeah.
Mike Harding was one of our own studio managers and a good guitarist. What happened was that John, I'd been asked to use John for the presentation of the concert programme. They preferred him to be using Alan. So that's what I did. But after about a year and a half of it, John and I didn't, I have to be honest, didn't always see eye to eye about who should be on the concert, because John's tastes were perhaps a bit narrower than mine were. Well, it wasn't just a question of my taste, but there were also some acts that I wanted to use which I felt should be on a concert programme, bands like Deep Purple, Black Sabbath, and one or two others. And John didn't really go along with that. And I said, well, and it became a bit of a problem, and I had a discussion with my then line manager, and he said, okay, well, let's try and sort it out. And so John came off it, and I then had the freedom to use whichever presenters I thought would be right for, you know, fitting nicely with the bands I was going to use. So hence Mike Harding did some of the heavy metal things, because he was doing the sort of heavy metal sounds of the 70s. Andy Dunkley had never broadcast before, so I brought him in. I mean, it was really a toss-up between him and Jeff Dexter, because I'd seen both of them obviously presenting on stage, and I know Jeff very well, and I like him, but in the end I thought Andy was probably the better bet for that. I mean, the funniest one of those was he introduced Hawkwind, and of course Hawkwind wanted to play the whole hour without any breaks, so it was like Andy saying, ladies and gentlemen, good evening, this is Radio 1 In Concert, tonight we've got Hawkwind. an hour later, ladies and gentlemen, that was Hawkwind. So that was one of his easier ones, but they were good. And then, of course, I also used Bob for the sort of more folky rock things, and Pete Drummond for quite a few of them as well.
Island Records started in Jamaica in 1959, was launched in England in 1962, and was very much the brainchild of one man, Chris Blackwell.
One of the things I'd say about Pete Drummond is that the reason I used him, not so much in concert, but for a lot of documentaries, he had a drama background, as you may well know. And there are some other good DJs who I would try to use presenting, and with a written script in front of them, weren't very good. But Pete could do that.
Anybody that was a fan, particularly in the 60s, and by this stage, the 1970s of the Rolling Stones, would have loved your six-part Rolling Stones story for Radio 1. How closely did you work with the band on that?
I put the idea to them, and their management said, yeah, okay, fine. And they were really very cooperative. I mean, I told them what I wanted Alexis to compare it, but Alexis...
this is Alexis Corner, right?
I'd been working with Alexis Corner since back in 1964. I used to do overseas blues programs with him, and he's a good mate, and I now still miss him desperately. But obviously he was involved in how the Rolling Stones started, so he'd be the idea of being a presenter as well. I don't know if people remember him. He used to do a lot of commercials as well.
So he
was brilliant on the microphone, yeah. and to time. He could talk to the second, which you had to do for commercials.
The Rolling Stones story. Part one, the early days.
Please allow me to introduce myself. I'm a man of wealth.
So I said I was going to use him, but he wasn't really available to do the interviews. We did do one mini interview with Mick Jagger, but I did all the interviews myself and then cut my voice out. And so I sort of did all the research and did a lot of the background people, and then I flew to America because the Stones were in America at the time. That was my first trip ever to America in January, February 73, and spent some time on the East Coast talking to various people, then flew over to the West Coast, where they were still putting finishing touches to their album, which they actually shouldn't have been doing because of these sort of regulations. But they were supposed to record it all in Jamaica, but anyway, they did do some finishing touches there. But they were very cooperative.
Well, we may not be able to define the nature of their game, but what we will attempt to do is to let the story of the Rolling Stones unfold itself through their own mouths and the mouths of people who've been involved with them during the last 10 years.
Alexis was a brilliant presenter. I would write scripts for him and say, look, you alter it the way you want to. And I got to know him so well that I pretty much wrote the way he spoke. But he had the freedom to alter them in the same way I would let Pete do it. But you would not... And actually, about Alexis, people have been really surprised when I said I used to make him script it. And I did, because we tried a couple without him scripting it, and they were a bit all over the place, and I didn't like it, because in a blues programme that were giving information, and I wanted it all correct. So once he wrote it down and had it in front of him, he was fine.
And not very long after that, another six-parter, you wrote and produced the Beach Boys story.
Yes, I did. Well, that was pretty much as a result of the Rolling Stones story, because I'd have been quite successful, and a representative of the Beach Boys got in touch with myself and said, would you fancy doing the Beach Boys? As well, I was absolutely knocked out by that, because I'm a tremendous Beach Boys fan. I've always loved vocal arrangements. I'm a choral singer, but not proper choral singer. I do sing in I sing now in a choir, and I did choral singing when I was at school. And in fact, some of us, that was back in the 50s, so some of us used to love the bands like the High Lows and the Four Freshmen, and used to try and do things like that. So when the Beach Boys came along, that's fantastic. Somebody's now made it into a proper pop sound. I jumped to the chance of doing that. I would have to say that it's actually much more difficult than doing the Rolling Stones story, which might surprise some people, but the Beach Boys are not an easy bunch of people, or were not, to work with.
That was it was a funny time for them as well, the 70s, wasn't it?
Yes, it was. I mean, the person that was very helpful was Carl Wilson. He did everything I asked him to do, and also tried to smooth the way through Dennis was not very cooperative at all, although I did eventually get the interview with him. And Brian, the bizarre thing about the Brian Wilson is, I mean, he was not touring or anything at the time. And Bob Harris, who I'd got in to narrate the series for me, he and I were in our hotel in Los Angeles, and because I'd been trying to get him to do it with no luck at all. And then we came back from doing something else one day, and there was a message at the hotel days before answer phone son saying, "Oh, there's a Mr. Brian Wilson called. He wants you to call him." So I called, and he said, "Oh, yeah, can you guys come over?" and so on and so forth. And so he lived in Bel Air at the time, and Bob and I went over there. And it was very weird. And he wasn't there. His wife Marilyn and his mother Audrey were both in the big living room, you know, where the famous sandpit was. And but she kept calling him. Marilyn kept calling him. Eventually, he came down and said, "Oh, hello, you guys." And he looked over and he said, "Oh, are they binoculars?" Well, I had sort of stereo microphones. I think he knew the difference between a pair of binoculars. And so I don't know what all that was about. And he said, "Oh, I've just written a new song, guys. Would you like to hear it?" And the piano was sort of, the grand piano had its sort of sharpened towards us. So Bob and I going, "Yes." And I'm trying to get my tape machine going. And he walked over to the piano. Now, the keyboard was away from us, so we couldn't see. And he lifted up the thing. He said, "Oh, Marilyn, where's the keys?" He said, "Oh, Brian, I forgot to tell you, we've taken away to have them clean and reset." Now, I don't know, because he then closed it. To this day, neither Bob or I know whether there were any keys there or not. He said, "Okay." He said, "Well, I'll just go and play it upstairs." And he disappeared. We never saw him again.
You're kidding.
We did not see him again. I swear to you.
BBC Radio 1 presents The Beach Boy Story, narrated by Bob Harris. This week, part one, beaches, boards, blondes and buggies.
I may not always love you, but long as there are stars above you, you never need to doubt it.
So for that, for the Beach Boys story, it was pretty much without Brian Wilson. I was able to use one or two old clips. I mean, it wasn't until many years later that Bob actually did get to interview him for Whistle Test.
Hello, my name's Bob Harris, and I'm a great fan of the Beach Boys. Now, that in itself may not qualify me to spend an hour a week for the next 6 weeks telling you about them and their career, but I do rate them as the most important and influential group to have come from America. I also think that much of their more recent music has been underrated and overlooked, and if this series can help to right that situation, then I'll at least have partly repaid the debt I owe for all the enjoyment their music has given me.
You had this relationship back in the old days with Elton John, in as much as you knew him a little bit. And then all of a sudden, by the middle 70s, he's this enormous star. He's in another stratosphere. But he's given a show, a one-off show on Radio 1. And I remember listening to this when I was a kid. I loved it. EJ the DJ. Yeah. Presumably not your idea for a title, Jeff.
I'm afraid it was, actually.
Oh, was it? Yeah, well, it's catchy.
Like Happening Sunday and various other things. I've got a penchant for terrible programme titles. But
you remember it. That's the thing.
Well, OK, yeah. No, I did have, actually. Well, I hope I say I did have. I hope I still have got a good relationship with Elton. I didn't see him very often. But I never had any particular problem with working with him. I mean, he could be moody. There's no doubt about that. And I did see him behave like that with other people. But, I mean, I'd worked with him so many times and done so many concerts with him within the BBC, so on and so forth. And then we did the amazing concert from Russia, the first ever stereo broadcast of any sort, by the way, out of Russia, which technically was quite an achievement apart from anything else, and thanks to the various BBC technical people. So, yeah, he was quite happy to do it. I mean, he's a great music fan, Elton. I mean, you know, especially at that time, he would have almost, you could mention any artist, any record to him, he was there before you.
Good afternoon, it's 3:30 on Good Friday, and this is Elton John, EJ the DJ. We were going to thank David Hamilton, but we decided not to, as it's the thankless job that he's doing. We're going to have an hour and three quarters of good music coming up, starting with Jefferson Starship.
November 1978, Radio 1 went from 247 to 275 to 85, and it was announced that broadcast hours would be extended in the evening. Andy Peebles was handed the task of presenting the show under your guidance, but the engineers were on strike initially, weren't they?
Yeah, it's a bit of a headache there, so we couldn't get the evening programme going. So Andy was already contracted, so Derek Chinnery asked us if we'd do a little sort of 1.5 hour slot. So we pinched a bit of Teddy Blackburn's time, I think. I can't remember, it was on the afternoons. And we were just slotted in a sort of pre-drive time.
Radio 1.
Yeah,
Sandy Peebles in the hot seat in Continuity B here at Broadcasting House, where the lights are low and the gentleman next door is looking absolutely splendid. Lit in stereo. Marvellous. No expense spared. The next record is for a lady who brought me a bottle of champagne last night. She shall be nameless, but she is an angel.
And it was a good introduction to working with Andy, who is a thorough professional, by the way.
You did have a great relationship together, didn't you? I mean, you were a partnership for a very long time.
Yes, because then later on, Derek Chinnery said, oh, I still don't know quite where Derek got the idea from, of asking us to do a sport and music programme. And it's like, am I hearing right? I mean, my two great loves in life, apart from my wife and family, of course, are sport and music. And you're asking us to do a programme. And the same with Andy as well. And I'm glad they chose us because, I mean, we were very, I'd like to think we're very professional about it. We try to go the right way about it and include as many sports as we can. And between the two of us, I think we covered most areas. I mean, into motor racing and I don't know, all sorts of others, athletics, football, cricket, and Andy was quite knowledgeable about rugby league, having lived up north for some time. We just tried to cover everything, and in fact, we even covered NFL football when the Super Bowl came round and so on. And I think that hadn't been covered on BBC Radio at all before.
12 minutes past 7 o'clock. On the sporting front, a bit of news comes through today from the BBC Sports Department that Sharon Davis is thinking about taking up swimming again seriously, and hopefully later in the programme, a few words from the lovely lady herself explaining her reasons. Peter Shilton is my guest, and he'll be joining us at 20 to 9 tonight to talk about the world of soccer. We have piles of good music, including a session tonight from four gentlemen who I got on with very well last night in Yorkshire. Strange, you're thinking to yourself. Well, we're all up in Harrogate, you see. I'll tell you a little bit more about it later in the programme. But they are talk.
You know, I've asked Andy and various other people who remember you over the years, obviously Jeff at Radio 1, and I have to say, very, very fondly thought of. In Concert is immediately the programme that springs to mind, but all these other ones that we've talked about as well. But our mutual friend Adrian just says, you've got to ask Jeff about possibly his crowning glory moment at Radio 1, where the network obviously was covering Madonna in Concert at Wembley, and it was your task to go and find her before the gig, have a little chat with her, recorded interview. Now, is it true that the bosses were saying you've got to tell her to keep her bad language down to a minimum?
Now, at that time, Roger Lewis was head of Radio 1 and Johnny Williams was controller. And they said, right, there's a chance that we might be able to get Madonna. I said, yeah, I know. They've been speaking to the people about it, you know, and we'd like to do her live. And I said, I'm not sure that's a good idea. And they said, why? I said, well, because, you know, I heard she's swearing a lot on them. And they said, well, look, and I always, by the way, when I was doing major artists, I always used to try and go and see them with my engineer beforehand. Quite often it meant trips out of the country, which wasn't too bad. And in this case, my engineer and I went to Rome to see her. She was very good. But she swore in Italian. I'm not that into Italian, but I know some Italian swear words, and she swore prodigiously in English as well. So when I came, a very good concert, and I spoke to her manager. I didn't get to speak to her at all, and I spoke to her manager and said, you know, Radio 1 wanted to do this live, but we can't have all that swearing on it. He said, well, I'm sure she'd be all right. We'll have words with them, son. So I came back and I said to Roger Lewis, I don't think we should do this live. I don't think that they're saying she won't swear. I'm convinced she will, especially if they ask her not to. I think that would be like a red rag to bull. So Roger discussed it with Johnny, and Johnny said, well, I'll leave it up to you. And Roger said, no, we really want it live. I said, well, okay. But of course, the way the BBC works, it's his problem, not mine, because I'd already said that I didn't think there's any way he could stop it.
I know a lot of radio disc jockeys who refuse to play a lot of the songs on my album. I mean, because of my controversial image and stuff. So, I mean, it's not like I can make a record and put it out there and nobody gets in the way and there's no sort of censorship or anything like that.
Jeff, it's an incredible Radio 1 career to look back on. In many ways, one of the great unsung heroes, although, of course, your contribution is very, very well known and respected by those that worked at the network through those years. Thank you very much for sharing your Radio 1 with us.
Thank you, Sean.